was at school to study nursing first, and then when later on I was at seminary reading theology, I distinctly remember receiving gentle cautions from my professors in both institutions about the use of humor. And they weren't ominous or pointed warnings. The lines had not yet been crossed, but they were just wise and well-placed pieces of advice. I think about two things. One was the danger of being dismissed as frivolous by using humor. And that sometimes happens. But also being aware of the power of humor and the need to be therefore careful in its application. Humor can bring life and it can bring joy, but it can also be used as a weapon. Can't you take a joke is a line that's been used to inflict all sorts of damage. And sadly, I've even seen it employed with deadly efficiency within the courts of the church, which is not so good. Humor and laughter are powerful, powerful things. And while I don't pretend to be the Robin Williams or Dave Chappelle of the pulpit, I do know that humor can be a most useful tool in sharing the gospel if used carefully. Now, when I was employed in the hospital, as you know, I worked in two places. I worked in the operating room and then for most of my career in the emergency room. And both of those, I think it's fair to say, can be reasonably high-stress environments. They aren't always that way, of course, but by their nature, they're places where things can go south fairly quickly. So to do the task effectively requires at least some attentiveness, because it's serious work. Lives literally depend on the staff not only being knowledgeable and skilled, but also that they're highly cognizant of actually what's going on in front of them. Because the human body is massively complex. It's far more of a mystery than we sometimes assert. And so being vigilant, even paying attention to what seem like little things, that can literally save lives. So it's a serious business. And you know, all that being said, one of my most enduring memories of those hospital days is laughter. For many of us, laughter was one of the key ways of maintaining our focus, of making an abnormal situation tolerable. And while I'm tempted to share some of those moments, I also know that they don't translate well into this venue. They would probably sound odd and perhaps even painful. It's one of those you have to be there kind of things. And it's because some of that laughter we shared was an expression of what's sometimes called black humor or gallows humor, a form of comedy that's found not in the suffering of others, but in the awareness of some of the absurdities we sometimes encounter of great stress. Black humor was very much a part of what we were. I think it's because laughter can help people regain some sense of balance when things are tough. The seemingly strange phenomenon of humor during the Holocaust, that has actually had some serious examination, because it's real. It was real. And it's understood that humor during that terrible event actually gave life. It focused attention on what was wrong. It even created some level of resistance amongst those who were experiencing it. And similarly, it formed a kind of a sense of solidarity with those laughing against their oppressors, helping them to cope with the horror, assisting those in the midst of it in some way to cling to sanity. As the philosopher and survivor of Auschwitz, Emil Fackenheim, noted, "We kept our morale through humor." And humor is regularly a feature of the work we do here together, I know. I was thinking about this over the last couple of weeks in relation to the death of Tevis's mom, my mother-in-law, Marie. It was, and to some extent still is, kind of hard slogging. Yet we've also known some moments of real humor, of great laughter during this time. And it's not a result of being distant or diminishing the loss or not caring. To the contrary, it's been related to being very close and caring a great deal. Sometimes we laugh to deal with our pain. On the other hand, it's often the case that laughter is connected to joy. Not everyone makes this link, of course, but for many of us, joy and laughter are regularly bound together. In C.S. Lewis' famous satirical novel, The Screwtape Letters, he illuminates elements of Christian theology rather ironically through a series of supposed letters sent from a practice demon whose name is Screwtape to his more inexperienced nephew, who's named Wormwood. And he advises him on the subtle art of temptation. Of course, Lewis is, by presenting the demonic attempts to bring human beings to ruin, he's attempting to alert us and protect us. In one of the letters, Screwtape is revealed to be quite concerned about humor being a manifestation of joy. And because joy comes from the enemy, the demon's enemy is God, and therefore it's dangerous to their scheme to damn and destroy human beings. And so in one letter, Screwtape writes this: "I divide the causes of human laughter into joy, fun, the joke proper, and flippancy. You will see the first among friends and lovers reunited on the eve of a holiday. Among adults, some pretext in the way of jokes is usually provided, but the facility with which the smallest witticisms produce laughter at such a time shows that they are not the real cause. What the real cause is, we do not know." A little aside here. The devils don't understand the notion of joy. Anyway, back to the quote. Something like it is expressed in much of that detestable art which humans call music. And something like it occurs in heaven, a meaningless acceleration in the rhythm of celestial experience, quite opaque to us. Laughter of this kind does us no good, and should always be discouraged. Besides, the phenomenon is of itself disgusting and a direct insult to the realism, dignity, and austerity of hell. Ironically, Lewis has so much fun with the humorless and joyless demons. Certainly my own experience is that there's a connection between God and laughter, and as I've related to some of you here before, some of the most critical moments I've experienced in my time as a follower of Jesus, and things like conversion and call to ordered ministry being the most notable examples, they were accompanied by this sense of joy, and for me, laughter. And I think a part of it has been the sheer absurdity of the notion that God might be interested in using me. Unbelievably funny. So God and laughter are very much connected in my own spiritual journey. Now, there's lots of humor in the Bible, though the passage of time and the differences in language and culture make some of it a little tricky for us to pick up on. The Bible's got some deliciously funny stories. For me, the story of Gideon is a prime example. And Jesus' parables were likely more often than not to have caused all sorts of laughter amongst his hearers. The subject of laughter doesn't get a lot of mention in the Bible, but it does get some. A good many of those references to laughing are actually related to the derisory laughter of one's enemies over us when we fail or when we're defeated. I do note that there are a couple of mentions of laughter in the Gospels. One of those is the time when Jesus is asked by a leader of the synagogue to bring the life of his daughter back, saying to Jesus that if he just lays his hand on her, he knows that she'll live. And so Jesus heads off to the leader's house, and this is the episode. Remember, there's the brief interruption when the woman with a hemorrhage touches Jesus' garment and is rather surreptitiously healed. But he gets to the house and he dismisses the professional mourners and the friends and the neighbors who are outside. And he says to them that the daughter isn't dead, she's just sleeping. And they all in turn, they laugh at Jesus. So it's another example of the scornful laughter that's commonly referenced in the Bible. But of course, who's the last laugh on? Because as the story plays out, the child gets up when Jesus takes her hand. The other time laughter is mentioned is in the Sermon on the Plain, which is in Luke's Gospel. It's just rather like Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. And in one of the many blessed bees, or blessed are, as I should say. And Jesus says, blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. So this is the laugh that happens when everything's turned around. The ending is that delightful one that you just weren't expecting. Incidentally, the only other mention of laughter that I could find in the New Testament is in the letter of James, and he's recommending turning our laughter into mourning, so don't ask, we'll save that for another sermon. That would just confuse us today. But in the Old Testament, the first mention of laughter in the Bible is our scripture reading for this morning. And I wouldn't want to describe it as scornful so much, but it is an example of reacting to what seems to be unbelievable. And it's just gut-splitting, literally fall on your face, the, oh, you've got to be kidding me kind of mirth and hilarity, something that renders you incapable of doing anything but rolling around on the floor. It's that kind of laughter. It's unbelievably funny. And what brought this about? Well, let's look. About six chapters previously in Genesis, we're introduced to a couple named Abram and Sarai. And they live in Mesopotamia, what we would today call Syria and Iraq. God spoke to Abram, told him to call U-Haul, pack he and Sarai's things, and they're to make their way to the land of Canaan, that general area that surrounds modern-day Israel. And in the beginning of chapter 12, God says, I'll make you a great nation and bless you. I'm going to make you famous and you'll be a blessing. In fact, I'll bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. And then there's this intriguing statement. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So with that strange promise in mind, a couple, somewhere in their mid-70s, we're told. Bit of humor in that picture, I think. They leave the land of their families and they head to Canaan. Now, a variety of things happen over the next chapters, including some rather sordid stuff, truth be told. But God establishes this covenant with Abram, promising Abram and his descendants a great tract of land. Well, that's great news, but what about this business of descendants? You see, Abram and Sarai, they haven't produced any children. And so Sarai, in some desperation to help God, by the way, there's always danger when you decide to help God. Don't worry, Lord, I've got this. And that rarely ever ends well. Anyway, Sarai quite generously offers her slave girl Hagar to help Abram out. Oh dear. Okay. Then Hagar becomes pregnant. Sarai then gets her a bee in her bonnet about the success of the very plan that she actually came up with. She didn't like the look in Hagar's eyes. And Abraham offers this rather limp, hey, she's your slave, Sarai. carefully backing out of the tent and revealing a rather impressive lack of character. This is another version of, hey, it's all Eve's fault. I was just doing what I'm supposed to do, you know. But it's interesting here, I think. The raw material for this great nation God is planning is far, far from perfect. They're not especially heroic. Rather, they're these obviously flawed and fallible human beings. Anyway, in time, Hagar delivers a boy, and he's named Ishmael, who will go on to be a key figure in Islamic theology, interestingly enough. Then we come to our reading for this morning, which begins with the news that Abram is 99 years old, and God takes him aside and offers another version of the previous covenant, promising Abram, who's now renamed as Abraham, which means in Hebrew, father of multitude, of a multitude. Abraham is promised that he will be the ancestor of many nations and that this covenant is everlasting and that the land of Canaan will be theirs forever. So, on the face of it, this is about children and land. That's what this is about. Now, the writers of the order of readings we use then leave off at verse 7 only to pick up the story at verse 15 for some mysterious reason. Well, I suspect it's not really much of a mystery at all. They're actually a bit embarrassed about the subject matter in those verses, 8 to 14. You see, those next 8 verses introduce the notion of circumcision being a sign that Israel is keeping the covenant. And circumcision, hey, how do you preach on that? Incidentally, before I retire, I'm already working on some possible sermon titles. But not this week. So, at verse 15, God changes Sarai's name to Sarah and promises Abraham that she'll be blessed by bearing a son who will give rise to nations, at which point Abe falls to the ground sobbing with laughter. And he barely manages to squeak out, "How can this happen to a guy who's 100 and to a woman who's 90? You're killing me here, God." And perhaps even now he's starting to wonder, what the heck do we do with Ishmael? Oh dear. Beware of trying to help God. Abraham's disbelief, his lack of faith, his struggle to believe God's promise only highlights God's staggering faithfulness. And if we were to skip to a chapter later, we'd be treated to the account of some mysterious visitors saying that Sarah's going to have a son, and she breaks up as well, the thought being laughably outlandish to her. And then, three chapters later, she does conceive and bears a son named Isaac, a name that means he will laugh. All of which, to this, Sarah declares, "God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me." This is not derision. This is pure joy. It's the great reversal. I thought it was going to be this, but look, it turned out to be that. It's as if God said, "You think this is going to turn out badly? No, 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 no. I'm the God who's made you a promise, and I keep my promises. So watch this." Maybe this seems like a bit of a strange reading to hear during Lent, because, I mean, Lent is so often viewed as a more sober kind of season. And while it's not intended to be funereal, I think it's safe to say that Lent's not typically a period that we, well, at least traditionally, connect with laughter and with humor. But nonetheless, those who assembled our order of Bible readings have delightfully, and I believe wisely, given us this little gem for this week. Ours is a God who brings life out of what can seem to be a hopeless situation. As the author of the letter to the Hebrews wrote, "Abraham was one who was as good as dead. And yet from he and Sarah there were descendants born as many as the stars of heaven and as innumerable grains of sand by the seashore." This God who has revealed himself to us has made a covenant with us, has established the terms of a relationship with us, and is determined to bring life out of what seemed to be, and perhaps to you and me on some difficult days, might still seem to be a hopeless situation. A situation that brings forward a derisory laugh on our part. So it strikes me that this is indeed a most robust Lenten theme. Especially on a Sunday, a day we take special care to note is in Lent, but not of Lent. Every Sunday is a celebration of the resurrection, and that is no less true during this serious season. On Sundays, we rejoice in God's refusal to break covenant with us. A God who in the early hours of that first Easter morning whispered, and I wonder, perhaps with a laugh, "Watch this." And in joyous disbelief, we join with that great long line of the saints who've gone before us and laugh with delight at this great reversal. The revelation that though we were as good as dead, God has moved to save us. For Christ is risen. Amazing. Thanks be to God. Amen.